Welcome to another episode of Between Bites. Nina and I are joined today by a New Orleans legend. He'll get mad at me for saying that, but it's true. Chef Frank Brightson of Brightson's Restaurant is with us. Welcome, Chef.
So nice to be here with you guys. Thank you, Larry and Nina.
Always a pleasure.
Of course. Well, as we looked around and decided who we wanted to speak with, you were at the top of the list. And for one of the reasons was you were one of the first friends we made when we got here. To have somebody who was so important in the culinary scene be that nice to us when we moved to town almost 8 years ago, that meant a lot to us. And through these 8 years or so, we've gotten to know each other pretty well. But we found you a pretty neat fella to talk to and thought you would be fun here on the podcast today.
Well, that's nice to hear. I remember when you guys came to town. And I think one thing that people overlook is that New Orleans is well known for its food and music and architecture, but it's the people that make this place special. And a mutual friend had told me that you were looking for a place here in town, so I was anxiously awaiting your arrival.
Well, for me, as you said, it's a very well-known city for music and food and everything else. So for me, being a chef moving here, I was very nervous because, you know, you have the heavyweights, yourself, Donald Link, Leah Chase, Emma Lagasse. So coming here, I'm like, oh my gosh. I told Aaron, like, I says, please just try and move here quietly, and it's open very quietly, but that wasn't the case. But, you know, just the warm welcome we received, it just made us feel like this was the right move, and we don't regret not a second. We love living here, and we just love the people and the friendships, and the true, genuine friendships that we got over the years.
That makes me very happy, Nina. You know, I grew up here, and I've always worked here, but when you travel a little bit, you see how other places are, and it made me appreciate the sense of community here in the culinary world. Restaurant people in New Orleans don't view themselves as competitors. We just don't. We are a community.
Yep.
We see a lot of the same guests. We help with fundraisers. We help each other out when we need it. And I think that's a blessing, and it's something that's very special about, you know, New Orleans.
Another thing we share in common is that in each of our respective restaurants, we work with our family, with our spouse. You took it to an extreme. You work with your wife and her sisters. How is that?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, for 36 years, it's been lovely. Just lovely. And it's really, you know, it's part of my story. You know, Sandy, the older sister, was one of the first waitresses at Cape Paul's back in the 70s. And I was the first night chef, and that's how it all started. And, you know, one by one, Rhonda came to town to work with us, and then Marna came to town one Christmas, and I fell in love with her, and she fell in love with me. And so I married three sisters.
But that helps with front of the house staffing as well.
It does, Larry. I've never had to worry about front of the house at all. I just make the soups and the sauces, and everything else seems to fall in line.
Were there ever a situation where they ganged up on you?
Well,
at work. We don't have to talk about it.
Huh? I have never, ever used the phrase scheming dames.
Out loud. It may have flashed through your mind.
It's a collaborative effort, without a doubt. And we respect our boundaries, you know, and we always welcome input from each other. And, you know, Marna and I, being husband and wife, she runs the business part of things, and along with Rhonda. And that's a lot of, you know, things that we have to discuss. And it's never been better, really.
So just backtracking to Cape Paul, just one of the stories I loved hearing from you was about the black and red fish and that creation. So if you want to share with our listeners how that dish came about, because it's still very vivid in my memory when you told me that story.
Thank you, Nina. I think it's an important story for people to hear, because there's so much conjecture and misconception about the origins of black and red fish. And back in the early days of Cape Paul's Louisiana Kitchen, they opened as a lunch place, 4K, really. and Paul was still executive chef at Commander's Palace. And then after about 3 months, his contract was up, and then he came over to Cape Paul's full time. So he was working with me at night. I got off the stove and expedited for him. Mm-hmm. And you know, one day I was setting up my mise en place, which is across two boards across the doorway. It was pretty makeshift. And we opened at 5:30, and about 5 o'clock, Chef quietly came to the kitchen and went to my mise en place and pulled out a piece of redfish and seasoned it and had heated up a cast iron skillet, and he dredged it in melted butter and put it in the black iron skillet. Now I'm like 2 feet away, frantically trying to get set up, and I see this billowing smoke coming out of the skillet, and I'm like, whoa, I was so very skeptical. But, you know, yes, chef, always trust chef.
Yeah.
And then he turned the fish, flipped it over, and it was blackened on the top. And I was even more skeptical.
Right.
And just trying to get set up, nervously, you know, frantically trying to get set up. And then the fish was done. He took it out of the skillet, put it on a plate, and said, "Here, Frank, taste this." And so I grabbed a piece of it with my fingers and ate it. And it was the best damn fish I ever had in my life.
Wow.
It was that good, just by itself.
Right.
And so now it's 5:30, the front door's open, there's a line of people waiting to come in, they all start streaming in, and Paul goes out with this one plate of redfish and starts offering people a taste. Just take a piece with your fingers. And that was the first blackened redfish at Cape Paul's.
Amazing. Amazing.
When did it hit you, or did it ever hit you, that the people you were working with every step of the way as you came up in the restaurant business ended up being very big deals, to the point, I know you're very humble about this, that you're an extremely big deal to this city and nationally for, you know, our cuisine here in New Orleans. When did it hit you that, man, I have worked with the best people all along?
That's a good question, Larry. And really, I think, you know, for myself and a lot of chefs in my generation, we didn't go to culinary school. I didn't even know there was such a thing. And as time went on, I started to realize how critical my months at Commander's Palace were. You know, we learned on the fly, you know. Nobody took the time to say, okay, let me show you how to make trout meuniere. You learned under... you know, fire. And I did. And I think back to those chefs, Leroy Thomas and Jay Blair and Armand Jante, who really gave me my introduction to fine cuisine. And in the Cape Paul's years, as the restaurant grew and got busier, Paul brought in more chefs. And Raymond Sutton, who had worked at Brennan's and worked at Commander's, and you know, this generations of African-American Creole chefs who have been the backbone of this cuisine for generations at the Galatoires, the Brennans, the Antoines. And so I got a taste of that from Raymond Sutton. George Rode was another one. We're still friends today. He was younger than me, but I got to work next to him for a few years. And I learned so much from George, and I'm still learning from George. He's the most brilliant chef I know, present company excepted. So this is how I learned. And it's not textbook learning. It's learning the nuances of sauce making and soup making and timing and how to be a line cook, the mechanics of motion.
And that's often the biggest praise chefs can give each other, is to say that guy or that woman can cook. They're a great cook. And, you know, it's neat to come up like that. But did you ever reflect, or when did it hit you, that Chef Paul was as big as he was, or Miss Ella was as big a deal as she was?
It was about 1980, Larry, and it was a very special time because it was my formative years. I was 26 years old, learning at Cape Paul's. Black and red fish had become a thing. Cajun food became the number one food topic in America and the world. And at the same time, there was a revolution in our country, in our restaurants. And it was pioneers like Paul Prudhomme, Larry Forgione in New York, Alice Waters in Berkeley, and Wolfgang Puck in LA. They were changing the way we eat, mainly by getting to the source of the food and getting it fresh and then taking it from there. So this, what we now call farm to table, was started then in 1980, about that time. And I remember one specific day where it did hit me, and it was the time that Chef Paul was invited to go to New York to appear on the Today Show. This was his first national appearance. And Craig Claiborne, the food writer for the New York Times, had a lot to do with introducing Paul to the world. So the Today Show calls, invites him up, and it was a big deal. So Kay went too. So this was the first time neither Paul nor Kay were in Kay Paul's restaurant during service. So naturally, something happened.
Oh.
It snowed that day in New Orleans. We got a ton of snow, like almost half an inch.
That is a lot for here.
So I'm at work, and you know, there's, you know, a few flakes falling. And the mayor at the time declared a state of emergency and asked all downtown businesses to close so that the employees could get home to the safety of their homes. So John Strand, the bartender, and I were the two running the restaurant. So we started talking what they want to do, and I'm like, let's just open. I mean, we're here. It's not that bad.
Right.
We talked, and then we decided, let's call Chef. So I called Paul in New York. I told him what I just told you, and there was silence, a big pause. And he said, Frank, do what you think is best. So I said, we're open. I said, thank you, Chef. We're open. And not only that, I opened the place 15 minutes early because there was a line of people still. And the wait staff,
and they were
still
getting snowed on.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's why I did it. And the wait staff still hates me for that. But we broke a record that night. We did 250 people.
Oh,
man.
With 50 seats. We did five
turns. That's impressive.
Right. So when Paul got back from New York, Paul and Kay, Paul walked in the kitchen with his cane with the biggest smile I've ever seen. And he said, I heard you broke a record.
That's awesome.
I said, yeah, I did. But that was his introduction to the world, you know, when he really became on everybody's tongue. And he never stopped.
That's awesome.
So I have a question. You've been cooking for a long time, and you have cooked a lot in New Orleans. Is there any dishes that you see that people don't make anymore?
Well, that's...
And you wish came back. Like,
yeah, that's
more
a very good
that
question. You know, the what we New Orleanians refer to as the neighborhood restaurant, it's hard to find any of those anymore. Mm-hmm. And the specials those kinds of restaurants ran, like Stuffed Melaton, Stuffed Bell Peppers, things like that, you don't see anymore. You know, we love to stuff our vegetables, and that means that means seafood,
yeah,
and probably a cream sauce. But even red beans and rice, you know, there's a couple of places that always have it, but it's no longer the Monday tradition,
right,
that my mom always adhered to. But I, you know, it's funny, Nina, when we opened Brightson's in 1985, our first review, but the great Gene Borg, was a glowing review, and it was kind of a Frank's the new kid on the block, quote, reinventing Creole cuisine. I said, wow.
Look at me.
I didn't realize I was doing that. So I was a fresh face. And now 36 years later, I'm viewed as the old school traditionalist, and I'm still doing what I did 36 years ago.
That's interesting.
I like this mantle a lot more. There's less pressure, number one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I take it on my own shoulders to keep making the trout meunier, to keep doing the bread pudding, whatever it does takes to propel Creole cuisine and culture forward. you know, like I know, there's a reason classics are classics because yes. they're good.
Yes.
And so we try and walk the line and keep a balance between keeping things fun and fresh, but also maintaining the standards that people expect. What I call cravers, the types mm-hmm. of dishes that people know what they're going to order before they get there.
Yep.
And then there's new stuff or different stuff for people that want to try something new.
And how tough is that for you, having the cravers, and especially 36 years with the cravers, when you have a new idea of something you want to put on the menu, and there's only so much room on a piece of paper, so much room in the walk-in and on the line? How do you judge?
Well, that's a great question too. And the first thing that pops to my mind is my staff, the chefs in the kitchen, because they are the ones making these dishes over and over and over again. And human nature means you get tired of it.
Yeah.
You know, saute station, you're making trout meuniere or flounder meuniere and barbecue shrimp over and over and over again. And repetition breeds perfection, but it's also boring. So what I try and convey is that as chefs, we have to remember that we are in food service. And we're not cooking for ourselves, we're cooking for the guests. And our goal is to make them happy. So we, you know, if somebody's getting a little burned out, we try and change it up.
Well, it's kind of like being the Rolling Stones. You've got all these songs, and you can't play all of them. And, you know, maybe somebody's going to be disappointed that Jumpin' Jack Flash wouldn't. Well, that's not the best song. But
no,
the Trout Meuniere is not there that night. Or not Trout Meuniere, but something else.
It has to be.
It has to be there. And it's got to be played perfectly.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you ever love a dish yourself, put it on the menu, and it didn't go over as well with the dining public as you thought?
Yeah, we've had a few like that.
But it's disappointing, isn't it? Because you get so fired
totally.
Up. It's you're birthing a child, and you're out here, and everybody's
And you hope that everybody enjoys the way that you enjoy.
Yeah, yep. That's right. And I wish Chef Larry was here, because he would remember them. He's been with me 30-plus years, and there are a couple that we've done. I'll think of one in a second. But yeah, we loved it. And if the wait staff doesn't like it, it ain't going to sell.
It doesn't sell.
Yeah,
they are
the salespeople.
Yes, they are,
and the guests can see it in their eyes.
Well, we could also say that you guys are blaming the front of the house now for the inability of a dish to sell, but we won't go there. In this, if you had to put together, we won't call it your death row meal or your last meal, but the ultimate all time South Louisiana meal. What are a couple appetizers, a couple entrees, a couple desserts that you personally have to have, not selling to anybody?
Oysters on the half shell, at least one dozen.
Okay.
I might have another dozen for dessert.
Cocktail sauce or no?
No.
Okay.
I like my oysters au natural, just straight up. I slurp them out of the shell. But I do love cocktail sauce.
I don't. Oof.
But what I do, I think it interferes with the oyster.
It does. It definitely does.
So I'll eat my oysters simply by themselves, and then afterwards I'll eat crackers with cocktail sauce.
Just to fortify it.
Just a chaser, right?
Yeah, it kills your palate. It destroys the oyster.
That's a deconstructed
oyster
cocktail on a cracker. Look at you. See? You were always there in the end.
And gumbo.
Gumbo.
And 30 years ago, I would have said seafood gumbo, but now for me, it's filet gumbo with chicken and andouille sausage. Mm-hmm. When Chef Paul put that on the menu at K. Paul's, I hated it. I'm like, that is not gumbo.
Hated it taste-wise or
no,
philosophy?
No,
the whole idea. Yeah.
Where's the seafood? Where's the okra? It's a Cajun country thing. That was not in New Orleans gumbo. Now you find it, you know, in quite a few places, but it really rubbed me the wrong way. But over time, it became my favorite dish on the planet.
Huh.
Wow.
Yeah. When we returned to New Orleans after our Katrina evacuation, that's what I wanted. So I went to the restaurant and got my gumbo pot and all the ingredients, and I asked Mara to call up every staff member she could find and get them over to the house. And that pot of filet gumbo brought us home.
Wow,
that's
cool. Amazing. Yeah. It's, you know, I think when people talk about food, it's really about a memory.
It is.
You know, it's, you remember when you take that spoonful of that gumbo, it takes you back to something, and that's what's special about food. And I think that's why I love cooking, because seeing somebody's reaction when they take that first bite, like their eyes light up, they start to smile, like that brings me so much joy. And I think that's why we do it.
Absolutely, Nina. And you know, there's dishes you grow up with that bring you that joy. You know, we have this emotional passion, a passionate attachment to certain dishes that do resurrect all these beautiful memories and comfortable memories. And that's the restorative power of food. And that's why these are called restaurants, because we're not here to just feed people, but to restore their spirits.
Yeah.
And my next course would be my mom's red beans and rice.
Yeah.
Gumbo and red beans and rice. I know. But yeah.
You're the one making the answers. The rest of us just follow along.
And what about desserts?
Desserts, there's one. It's from my very young years. I must have been six. And I remember sitting on the carport with my dad with a hand crank ice cream machine.
Yeah.
Making peach ice cream with Rustin peaches. That was the best ice cream I've ever had in my life. I've tried to duplicate it and I can't. I'm guessing.
I don't think that's true.
I have not duplicated it. Maybe the memory's so sweet I can't approach it. But
right.
I'm pretty sure there was a can of condensed milk in there.
That helps. That helps.
So speaking of childhood memories, how did you start cooking? What was the aha moment for you when you said, I want to be a chef?
Well, that actually came rather late in my life, Nina. You know, I did not cook as a young man. I mean, I made hamburgers and I fried bologna and my mom's cast iron skillet for my sandwiches. But in college at LSU, I had to get a job, and some friends of mine were working at a sub shop called Blimpy Base. So I went and got a job with them to be with my friends.
Right. Yeah.
And became a manager, and then I moved to a little pasta place and cooked there and managed there a little bit. And then when I moved back to New Orleans, that's when I knew it's what I wanted. I majored in fine arts in college, so that was not a good way to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
But by end of college, I knew that I wanted to be in the kitchen. And I know everybody has to make that, in our business, has to make that call. Do you want to be front of the house or back of the house?
Right.
And I knew clearly I wasn't made for the dining room.
Yeah,
yeah, but that maybe back then. But
yeah.
Now you float around. It's like there's a halo and an aura around you when you do come out and talk to people.
Well, you grow the confidence.
Well, I think that's probably what it is, Nina. And it's a great point, Larry, because in the early years of Brightson's, they could not drag me into the dining room.
That's the way Nina is.
Table 14 wants to say hello. Well, I'm really busy right now, and I just hated it.
Yeah.
It was a klutz, awkward, couldn't talk. And now 36 years later.
I don't believe that, but go ahead.
I love it. I mean,
yeah.
This is why I go to work every day. It's the people, my staff, and my guests, and the three sisters, of course. but I go home with a glow from meeting new people, seeing older friends, hanging with my staff, engaging with them. That's why I go to work every day.
It's, you know, I agree with you, the front of the house, Larry, like, they wanted to go say hello to you. They're from St. Lucia or whatever it is. You try and pull me out, and I'd be kicking and screaming, no, Larry, I'm really busy. And then when I go to the table, just seeing their face light up because they're so excited to meet you and say they're having a great time. Like, I walk away and I go back to the kitchen and I'm smiling.
Right.
So it becomes contagious when you have that moment where you're meeting a complete stranger, but you brought them joy. And that's, again, that's what makes me happy.
That's our fulfillment, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that I think I wish my staff, my chefs could see more of. Because, you know, as young chefs and line cooks, we go to work, we do our prep list, we're in our tunnel vision and blinkers on, and we don't see the full circle of the dining experience, and I wish they could share more in that.
All right, so let's fast forward to the future. Where do you see the dining scene moving towards, let's say, 5 years?
Wow.
What do you see the landscape looking like?
I think it's going to be very different. I think the pandemic has rocked our world in ways that are still unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
So on that level, you know, I think the dynamics of our business are different. Everything costs more, everybody knows that. And I don't think it's gonna go back. Supply chain issues have to do with so many factors, including the people part.
Yeah.
Who's gonna shuck the oysters? Who's gonna pick the crab meat? Who's gonna harvest the lettuce? So that, I think, is gonna be with us for a while. So what does that do to us in a restaurant business? The old formulas we used to use based on food costs and labor costs, those formulas don't work anymore. So what that means, it can only mean one thing, and that's higher menu prices.
Right.
So then you look at the guests, the diners. How much do they enjoy this experience? Are they willing to spend X amount more to enjoy this experience? I think fine dining is in trouble. It will always be here, but I think it's going to play a different part in the landscape of our culture. And then look at today's 20-year-olds, today's 25 and 30-year-olds. Are they going to want fine dining? I don't know. To me, the landscape is more about casual. Whether it's a coffee shop, a taco restaurant, whatever it might be, stuffed bell peppers.
Right. Maybe make a comeback, right?
Right. Maybe the blue plate special will make a comeback. But people want to hang out. That's what they want to do. They want to sit there and play with their phones and do Instagram. And, you know, I'm not sure if fine dining is going to hold its same place 5 years from now.
I think it will.
But people still have birthdays and you know, they come to town, they want to explore the culture of the city they're in. Fine dining is where they're going to go. We're not going away, but I think we need to sort of reshape ourselves.
I think the trend has definitely been more of a casual situation, but I think a lot of it has to be with the consumer not understanding what it takes to run a restaurant.
Exactly.
Restaurants are very hard to run before the pandemic.
Yes.
And it's even harder now. Everybody knows that the margins are razor thin. I don't think they really know what it takes to make a profit to have a restaurant.
Right.
So when everybody, when the pandemic, everybody said, just pay your staff more. Yes, I will, but it has to get passed on to somebody. You know, when you talk about a case of butter now is $150.
I know.
So all of those things add up. And I think that for a very long time, we have so many restaurants, not just in New Orleans, but everywhere. Restaurants are just popping up. And I think we had so many choices to go to and pick and choose. And I think that's still gonna be the case. And I think what people are looking for is really the bargain. I think people probably eat out less now because it adds up.
Yeah.
You know, you say, let's meet friends for drinks, and then you get that check like, oof, I can't do this 3 times a week. Maybe I'll do it once a week. So you'll definitely see that trend still hang around for a while.
I wonder about people like us, chef-owned businesses. You know, for a chef who's really good to open his or her own restaurant right now, to me, that's a scary proposition.
We had a manager meeting like a year ago. We sat everybody down and said, you know, where do you see yourself in 10 years? And most people said, initially, I wanted to open my own restaurant, but the pandemic scared me straight. So a lot of people, the commitment to actually opening their own restaurant, it's a very scary thing. Because the chances of 1 in 5 restaurants making it is actually 4 out of 5 not making it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's always been like that also. And
the pendulum, it will swing back, but okay. It's going to take some time.
I think so. And, you know, there's this, the biggest asset we have is that this is just such a fun business.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it.
Well, I mean, could you see yourself doing anything else?
No.
I can't either.
No.
Nina had some bad, what would you do, Nina?
If I had to change careers, I'd be a DJ.
Nice.
I would be a DJ.
I like that.
Fortunately, Fortunately, she loves cooking, so.
I do, but I vibe off music.
I like that.
Like, music is a big, and that's going to be my next question, but music is such an important part of my day. Like, I wake up in the morning, I put music on.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I am answering emails or jumping in the shower, I have to have music on. If I come to my restaurant, I tell the office manager, where's the music? What are we listening to today? And I think it just creates a very fun environment,
yes.
You know, because we do spend a lot of hours in the restaurants, and I want to have fun when I'm doing that, and I want to be in a good mood, and music definitely sets the right mood.
But that's you. Do you have music in the kitchen?
No.
I used to not have music in the kitchen from Pilipin, and during the pandemic, you know, we were doing meals for restaurant workers and, you know, hospital workers.
Frontline
well.
Workers, yeah.
I said, let's just put the music on, you know, because it was a very morbid time, and
yeah.
We never had any music on in the kitchen.
Yes.
And it kind of just raised the spirits a little bit.
Right. Oh, I agree with that, and I'm a big believer in music. When I was, you know, in college and even beyond, I had music on at home constantly,
yeah.
And I'm talking albums.
Right.
So
what would you listen to?
Jazz. Jazz and reggae.
Oh, who's your favorite reggae artist?
Oh, my God.
Bob Marley doesn't count.
No. I saw him live, by the way.
Did you really?
Oh, yes.
Where?
At the Warehouse, which used to be a concert venue here.
Wow,
where all the acts
I'm
stayed.
So jealous.
I know. There was a show. I like, back going back to when I listened to it, the Mighty Diamonds,
mm-hmm.
which is a vocal group mainly. Burning Spear.
Burning Spear is a good
yeah.
one, yeah.
Peter Tosh.
Yeah, Peter Tosh is great.
Yeah.
Jimmy Cliff.
Jimmy Cliff, yeah.
We saw Jimmy
Thank
Cliff
you.
At Jazz Fest many years ago.
Yeah, it was the wettest we've ever
I don't,
been.
I don't have music in the kitchen. I know my early morning baker listens, but it's just her and someone else. That's
yeah.
fine. But I like to be focused now.
Back in college, when you were thinking you were going to become an artist, was there an instrument that you wanted to play? Or now, is there an instrument you wish you had played or stuck with? Or
yeah, you know, like a lot of kids in the 60s, my dad brought me down to Wehrlein's at 1964. Wehrlein's is where Palace Cafe is.
Yeah.
Wehrlein's was the music store in the city. And bought me a $25 Gibson guitar. So I learned,
oh, wow.
yeah, a couple of Beatles chords.
Yeah.
A couple of Beatles songs, and I could play Puff the Magic Dragon
there you
all
go.
Day long.
Oh, wow.
I wish I had the discipline when I was young to learn an instrument because it is so fulfilling, whatever it might be. In college, you know, in my crazy hippie days, I picked up a clarinet at I don't know where, used.
<Yeah. laughs>
And I had some creative friends, of course. So a couple of them were actual musicians. Joe Disney could play bass and Kevin played guitar. And somebody else always played bongos and me tooting on the clarinet. So we would get together at my house every couple of weeks and go crazy. And Kevin started calling our band the Atomic Janitors.
How about that?
Cleaning up after the atomic age.
Yeah,
we were crazy.
Wow.
Yep.
You even had a tagline. That's pretty strong. Who cooks at home? You or Marna?
Mostly Marna.
Yeah?
Yeah, she really takes such good care of me. I can't tell you. Every now and then I cook. Yesterday she requested barbecue chicken, so I barbecued chicken. And I bought potato salad and coleslaw at the store.
Nothing wrong with that.
No. Nothing wrong with that.
But, you know, if you're going to fire up the grill, you cook a lot of chicken. So
yeah.
She's got lunch for a few days.
Oh, that's nice.
But Sunday night's our thing. Sunday night's our sweet spot. We always make a nice dinner. Sunday night, she cooked dinner, and we did a pan-roasted salmon, which is something we do a lot because you can get it at the store,
mm-hmm.
and sautéed spinach and roasted potatoes, and then we sit on the couch and watch PBS or something on Netflix. Sunday night, don't call me.
That sounds like a very chill
That's
evening.
Our ritual
that
every
sounds...
Sunday night.
That sounds great. Recharge the batteries.
Yes.
What's the last thing you watched that really, like, was very polarizing for you?
Well, we've been on this polarizing. We've been watching The Blacklist, which is a powerful show. But I don't know how they produce so many seasons of this show. But we started watching it in on our vacation a couple of weeks ago, and we're plowing through that. The storylines are amazing, and some of them scary, but really well done show. And what else? We love PBS. I mean, it's just so beautiful.
It is.
From Grantchester to Hotel Portofino is the new show. But I watch them over and over. It takes you to a sweeter time.
Yes.
In some cases.
I do the same thing. We watch Casino.
Yeah.
On repeat. It's
yeah,
so good. I am just...
For some reason, Nina's relaxing television is...
Gangster movies.
Yeah, always somehow has a tinge of violence. That or Forensic Files.
I am intrigued by science. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about finding a thread of this fabric that was from the 1987 Mazda Miata that was only two in the state, like how they can narrow things down. It's so intriguing.
The good news is, through all this, she has learned there's no way to get away with murder.
There is no way. There is no way. They find you. They will definitely find you.
I make sure she watches that, and we have dogs that shed a lot. So there will always be fibers around.
Lucky you, Larry.
Yeah.
How many generations, and I'm not trying to make that you sound like an old person, but how neat is it? How much has it happened that you fed people as children and now they're adults?
Oh my
in?
Gosh, yes. Well, here's, I was going to talk about the Rosenblums. They've been eating with us since day one. Every Friday night, 7:30 p.m., same table for 36 years.
Wow.
And so we know their children and their grandchildren. We're good buddies. So that's three easy. The God Sagan, same way. They were every Thursday night for a while. So it's amazing. And a lot of the children that I fed are now married.
It's amazing. Nuts, huh? We have one. I mean, ours is, again, only restaurant open only a little over 7 years. But we had one who we were fascinated with her as a young woman. Bella, that she would eat tuna tartare and eat oysters.
She's working for us now for her summer job.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And she would talk about, I like my foie gras seared. She's just the best child guest you could have, because she was like, she'll eat anything.
Talk about making an impact.
Yeah.
Through food. Food is our medium, but it's a people thing. And look what you've done. For Bella,
yeah,
and what she's done for you. I see those smiles.
Yeah, it's neat. What's your favorite time of day in the restaurant?
I love the hour before we open. The kitchen staff is, winding down their prep work, and I like to see them get 30 minutes or so to relax and get their head straight, get off their feet, have a meal. The wait staff is in, they're setting up, they're going to have their meal. And in the last few years since the pandemic, I have my little table in the back of the hall, which is my office. And so I can just listen to all of these people going about their lives, and to think that Mara and I create this space for that to happen is so rewarding and gratifying. When we reopened after the lockdown in 2020, that was our goal. I wanted to be sure that every single employee got their jobs back, got their lives back, and with help we were able to do that. And, they're all still with us for the most part.
How good is your daily staff meal? I don't think there's any frozen pizzas being thrown in.
No, it's pretty damn good. The way we do it is each chef takes a week.
Okay.
So 1 week Larry's making it, 1 week Olivia's making it, 1 week Sam makes it. So you get a variety for sure. And We don't really buy specific items for staff meals, so they have to use their creativity. And there's some great results, you know. Nobody goes hungry, that's for sure. And there's a couple of our employees who really look forward to the leftovers. They box it up and take it home because it's their main meal for the
day. Yeah, and that's, I take family meal very seriously.
Yeah,
because
too.
There are a lot of people, they might work two jobs, and this is
right.
Their meal for the day. But also this is family. These are the people you work next to for many hours. So if you're going to nourish them, it needs to count.
Yeah, and that's the same with us. And, you know, there's one guy that actually does work two jobs, and he boxes up. You know, everybody got what they need, everybody done, and he'll take that home. And I know that's his main source of nourishment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My only regret about not having a freezer at Brighton is that we can't have corn dogs. So.
Well... Now
let me know when you do them here.
I've seen your corn dogs and the jalapeno corn dog, and so you make them. I know they're produced sometimes.
Yeah, they have to be fresh from scratch.
Absolutely, and that leads to our business venture that really is just a Instagram page at this point. But Frank and Larry's Corn Dogs.
Yeah, Frank and Larry's Corn Dogs. I thought we're up to 158 units now.
Well, that was sort of the idea.
You've been lying to me.
We forgot to actually organize and get an attorney. We forgot to open the first one.
We sure had some fun with it, though.
Corn dogs are amazing. And that's another one of the great things about you is you can spend this long at the height of Oak Cuisine in New Orleans and still love the corn dogs, still love the rice and beans. That's one of the amazing things to me about New Orleans is that there is a realness to it. That you're not going to see a lot of people in New York bragging that they had a corn dog or a hot dog from the hot dog stand on their day off, even though they're eating it. And maybe they don't love it, but you and I get excited when we see that great corn dog.
Yeah, and I think it's really just about being honest with yourselves. I mean, we had a ton of fun with that. And now I want a corn dog, but you know, if you ask most chefs, most of them will tell you they don't eat that well at home.
Right.
You know, I joke, but it's probably a lot of truth to it because it is for me. The biggest decision a chef makes when he or she gets home is, am I going to toast the bread for my sandwich or not?
That's true.
And do I have milk for the cereal?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's just the nature of the thing, you know. If you're an auto mechanic, you don't want to go home and change the transmission.
You just want to keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah, simple.
With creativity in people you work for, and I'll back up a little bit because you, more than anybody else, have devoted a good chunk of your time to teaching young people. And that is something that sounds very daunting. But between teaching down at Nichols in their culinary program and then here in New Orleans at NOCA, and this gets back to the chef being an artist and a trade, an art and a trade, as you've taught them the trade, you've taught them the technical, this is how you saute, this is how you bake. With the creativity, how do you teach a young person not to go too far? You don't need to put soy sauce in your red beans to call it fusion cuisine.
Yeah.
Where do you, how do you push them and then pull them back?
Well, that's a great question. And I've been teaching a long time, really since post-Katrina, so since 06. I taught for the public before that, but I've been teaching in schools that long, and it is a daunting task because it's hard. You know, teachers do a lot more homework than students, except we have to do it before class. But anyway, I do love it, and I'm starting up again in a couple of weeks, both at NOCA and at the John Post Culinary Institute at Nichols State in Thibodaux. And I'm looking forward to it. And the biggest reward for me is meeting young people. Again, it goes back to the people. And it's the food that brings us together. But my goal there is to, when I started in 06, I called my friend Randy Sheremy at Nichols. And I said, Randy, I want to come teach. Do you have a spot for me? And he said, oh, yeah, Frank, we need somebody to teach classic French. We need somebody to do soups and stocks. I said, no. I want to come and teach my stuff. I want to teach New Orleans cuisine. And this was a post-Katrina thing. I want to help protect and preserve New Orleans cuisine and culture. But what it evolved into is what I'm doing now. And I bring my recipes and we lecture. I lecture for about 30, 40 minutes, and then they are divided into teams and go execute the recipes. So occasionally there's a student or two that will deviate and add some creativity, quote-unquote. But that's not what they were asked to do. So for their practical final exam, I asked them to create a dish that utilizes Louisiana techniques and seasonings and ingredients. And my ask is that you, let's say you're working in a restaurant that the executive chef asks you to make Saturday night special. Give me that dish. And it's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. Most of them are really well done and brilliant, and occasionally there's one that's like, well, did you even read the assignment? But there's what the class does is it gives us a chance for interplay, to exchange ideas, and they are very good at that. You know, every student will come up to me and say, I had this, I had that the other day, I made this at Bistro, what do you think? You know, so there's a lot of interchange and exchange of ideas, which I think is really helpful.
How interesting was it to go into teaching having not been, grown up in an era where you didn't have to go to culinary school? You still do not have to go to culinary school, but now it is something that so many people choose to do, thinking that they want to do this to their bodies for the rest of their life. Was it interesting to see the difference in those young people's attitudes versus us who came up without those sort of things, without that formal education in the business and kind of on the job training?
Yes, absolutely. And I remember Randy Sheremy, who still works at Nichols, his advice to me, because I expressed some, I was nervous. I had never done it before. I'd never been in a, this kind of context with my teaching. And he looked at me and he said, Frank, you know more than you think you know. And that resonated with me and saw me through those first couple of years. And what I wound up saying is, and realizing is that teaching is the best education, because for me, I was forced to verbalize things that I have been doing for years. And so it kind of quantifies my craft for me. And so it's been a wonderful experience. And my fulfillment from it is to do for them, these young chefs, what Chef Paul did for me, which is give them an opportunity. Everybody deserves an opportunity, whether it's a class or a job or whatever it might be. But like when some of these students come to work for me, and I'm not on the station very often these days because of my age, but my joy in the kitchen comes from standing back and watching service unfold. And, somebody's learning saute, somebody's learning to expedite, and these are chances for these young people to grow and become the people they want to be. That's my joy.
You ever fail anybody in a class?
Never. I think that's
you're like an easy professor.
Yeah. Oh, I am. Believe me, everybody wants to sign up for my class. Is this going public? The worst grade I've ever given is a B.
A B?
Yeah.
Man.
You're generous.
I should have gone to Nickel.
What advice would you have for any home cooks, and also for younger people coming into the industry?
Yes.
What advice do you give them?
Well, for home cooks,
I think, number one, you should really put some effort into sourcing your ingredients. Be a knowledgeable and flexible consumer, and understand why something is there and why something is not there.
Right.
Eat seasonally. My example is boiled crawfish. If we had boiled crawfish all year round, nobody would eat it.
Right.
So eat Louisiana strawberries when they're in season. Eat Louisiana blueberries when they're in season. You know, if I want to make red snapper for dinner, well, there's no red snapper available, so make salmon or something
right.
else. So be knowledgeable in that. And then don't be afraid to change the way you do things, because a lot of us grow up doing like a brown roux, for instance, doing something the same way because that's the way you were taught. Go to YouTube and see Frank Wright's in dark room. It's 5 minutes, y'all.
Click subscribe.
But, you know, cooking, even for us, Nina, is about learning. We're always learning.
Always learning, yeah.
And trying new things. And that's part of the joy of it to me. Don't get stuck in a rut. And for the home cook, I'll tell you this, and this is my motto. In cooking, color is flavor, and brown is the color of flavor.
There it is.
Don't you dare put a boneless, skinless chicken breast in the oven and bake it with salt and pepper. Heat up a cast iron skillet, put a seasoning blend in that chicken breast, and sear it in that skillet, and then finish it in the oven.
Yeah.
And it will taste 20 times better. Brown things, there's a reason for that. And for those coming into culinary school and choosing this as a career, I would say be open-minded. Learn as much as you can. Save all your recipes one way or the other, because you might want one in 20 years, and don't take it for granted. Recipes are like songs. They are our life's work. And if I've gone to the trouble to write a recipe, there's a reason for it. It works, and it's going to work 20 years from now,
yeah.
too. So don't treat it lightly. But I think the best advice I give for culinary students is when they graduate and go out into the world, don't go looking for a title and a salary.
Well, that's tough.
Look for a happy place. You know, find a restaurant, kitchen that you think you could thrive in, and just get your foot in the door. Your performance will lead to opportunity. That's how it happened for me. My 6 months of commanders, I worked every station in the house, not because I asked to, because it was circumstances.
Right.
You know, this person didn't show up, so I learned
yeah.
how to make omelets.
Yeah.
So don't try to be a sous chef when you first graduate from culinary school. Sous chefs are mostly hired from within.
Right.
You earn that title. So don't overreach when you enter the workplace, but find a happy place. We all use the same pots, pans, spoons, spatulas, but every kitchen has its own vibe and personality, and it starts with the chef.
Yeah. That's the best advice, because I think a lot of people, like you said, they overreach, and then they apply for these positions they're not ready for, and they end up failing and not succeeding in that position. I think that's the biggest thing, is being open-minded, wanting to grow, being patient.
Yes.
I think a lot of people right now are skipping a lot of steps, and they're getting very impatient that they should be, you know, at this level at this time. And it's sometimes you have to just, they don't want to perfect things and then move to the next one.
Yeah.
They want to do it once and then like, oh, I know how to make a gnocchi today, so I'm on to the next thing. What people don't understand, like, cooking is a craft that you hone over the years. It's not over.
That's right. And it doesn't matter the dish either, Nina. You know, every salad should be made like you're making it for your mom or you're making it for Julia Child. Don't put that salad in the bowl. Place it in the bowl. You may be making 100 dishes a day as a line cook, but the guest is only getting one of them.
Yeah.
And if you send one or two plates out that could have been a little better, you've done a disservice to that guest who may be celebrating their anniversary and they only eat out once a year.
Right.
So you have to remind yourself constantly of the importance of making people happy. And I think for me, it's something we overlook too in our training, you know. I'll show you how to make a house salad six times if necessary.
Right. Okay, let's get into some fun stuff. If you are coming to New Orleans for the first time, what are three things that you have to do?
World War II Museum.
Yep. It's amazing.
It is amazing. And we're so lucky to have that here. Such an important part of our history here in America. And it's a wonderful, wonderful experience in so many ways. Get out of the French Quarter. Eat in the French Quarter, shop in the French Quarter, but also take one day to get out. Mm-hmm. New Orleans is a city of neighborhoods, whether it's Bywater, River Bend, Mid-City. There's so much to explore, and you get to meet the people.
Yeah.
You'll meet them in the quarter, too. The doorman, the Uber driver.
Plenty of characters.
Plenty of characters, that's right. You make a good memory. And I would say see some art, whether that's music or going to New Orleans Museum of Art, the Best-Off Sculpture Garden at City Park. City Park is a whole day. The Botanical Garden, the museum, the Sculpture Garden, there's Putt-Putt.
Nina won't play Putt-Putt. I keep trying to get, when it first opened, back when we got
I'll
out of the pin.
Putt-putt.
Okay, you and I will play
Putt-Putt.
I want
that to be a staff field trip. I haven't
that would be a great one. That'd be...
You guys can go have corn dogs for lunch.
Exactly.
I will be somewhere else.
Thank
Actually,
you.
We
but
can
you
add
can
Putt-Putt
get
to our corn dog.
City Park too.
Yep.
Morning call is there. City Park is a plus.
I love City Park. It's so calming. It's so sprawling.
You can
so
go horseback
beautiful.
Riding.
Yeah, I went horseback riding.
Horseback riding.
Yeah.
There's golf. There's so many
so
things
many
to do.
So many things to do. And it's just, it's right there. And
just walk.
You know what? You cannot go duck hunting in City Park. Did you know that? Yeah.
Have you tried?
Found out. Yeah, that was that. And it was frowned upon, and I didn't.
There's
like,
a bass fishing rodeo there.
Is there really?
In March.
Oh man.
I might sign up for that.
That's big bragging rights. They close the ponds off for a month, and then the rodeo's in late March, I believe.
How did I never hear about this?
Oh yeah.
Well, you learned something new.
You can go bass fishing.
I don't like going fishing with Nina because this is a true story. She catches fish on the first cast, and it is so annoying.
Like Marta.
It is just amazing.
I'm
we went
not,
trout fishing
I'm
last
not,
summer.
Fish magnet.
I am not.
It's amazing. She went fly fishing for the first time.
I did. That was very relaxing.
And she caught five trout.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm here. I am trying to give her the technical
wow.
advice
it
before
was,
she
never caught on a fly.
It's so relaxing.
It's beautiful.
It's.
If you didn't live in New Orleans, where do you think you would enjoy living?
Wow, you know, I made that list. Marn and I made that list when we were evacuated from Katrina, sitting in the Holiday Inn in Bossier City for a month.
Oof.
And we took out a sheet of paper and the road atlas that said, where else would we live? I might have wrote down one or two or three things and I crumpled it up and threw it away. Said, we're going back home.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. There's a lot of areas I love. It'd probably be along the Gulf Coast, I would guess. Bay St. Louis area is really nice. Fort Morgan, but I wouldn't want to be on the beach my whole year. But then again, you don't appreciate it as much.
Right. It's tough to figure out.
I like
because,
to be by the water.
See, you are both lucky enough and unfortunate enough to have lived in New Orleans most of your life.
Yes.
We've only been here 8 years, and Nina comes from the islands, down very south in the Caribbean. I grew up in Atlanta, then lived in Miami Beach where we met. And so we had seen some things, and we knew nice places and had nice lives. But then we got to New Orleans, and there's nowhere like it.
No.
And there isn't.
It's fun to visit places, but you sit there. We had a residency last year in New York City, and it was so cool. The first week we were up there, they were like, man, this is New York. This is cool. We're living out of a hotel, and we have a little restaurant here. And then you just realize after that wears off. And, yeah. You know, it's weird to think how round and rewarding life is here in New Orleans that you don't really see. Living in Paris, that would be great. But after a while, Paris is just a big city. It's not the something is always going on and the community is so tight.
But well, I think New Orleans definitely has a lot to offer. It is the only city that, if I tell somebody I live in New Orleans, they're like, I can't wait to come back. I love New Orleans. There are a lot of people that have been in New York, they live in New York, they live in LA, and they're like, oh, I hated it. I want to go into LA. Oh, there's too much traffic. Here, everybody says they love it. And that's very rare. And that says a lot about, like you said, the people. But there's just something about the energy here.
It gets in your blood.
It does. And it's very hard to just leave. It's. Every time I travel and I come back, I can't wait to come home.
Yeah.
Driving along.
With a new airport helps.
But we have friends that make an annual pilgrimage to New Orleans. Yeah. I have a friend I just wrote to today who lives in Jacksonville, Florida. I mean, they come every year. Now, there's also the Jazz Fest people that come every year. We see a lot of the same people. But these people just come in because it's New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And I see... people that went to Tulane, talk about getting their blood.
They come back every year.
They not only get a great education, they get a great cultural experience. Yeah. And they'll bring their children back, maybe to go to school or not. But they want to show their children where they went to college and absorb some of this lovely culture that we do have.
Yeah, it's definitely a very special place.
It's a gumbo.
Yeah.
It's a cliche, but there's no other word for it. You know, the way this city has evolved and continues to evolve over the last 306 years, whatever it is, seven. The demographics, you know, changed so much after Katrina. The diversity in this city is really special, and it's really something to embrace. And I think that's part of what makes us special. We love to tell, we want everybody to fall in love with New Orleans. That's what we want.
Yes.
Whether you're a chef, whether you're a doorman, whether you're a waiter, whatever it might be, if we know you're visiting, we want to make you have the best time you've ever had.
Well, Chef Frank, it was a pleasure catching up with you on Between Bites, and we will hope to see you in the restaurant, or we'll see you at Brighton's.
Always a pleasure, and I'm always happy to be at my favorite table in New Orleans, right here at Bywater American Bistro. Make way for the Reaper, y'all. Make way for the Reaper. Yeah, Bill! Make way for the Reaper. Make way for the Reaper. Back up, everybody back up, it was so rough.